Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the first academic conference call of the semester. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Colin Call with us today to discuss the ongoing situation in Iraq and the Middle East. Dr. Call is an associate professor at Georgetown University's Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service and senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. From February 2009 to December 2011, he served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the U.S. Department of Defense. In this capacity, Dr. Call was a senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Defense for Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen, and six other countries in the Levant and Persian Gulf. He's a regular consultant for the Department of Defense and Intelligence Community, and you can follow him on Twitter at Colin Call. Welcome, Dr. Call. Thank you very much for being with us today. We heard last night President Obama's strategy to combat ISIS. It would be great if you could talk about the threat of the Islamic State and President Obama's strategy that he outlined in last night's speech.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, and thanks to everybody for taking the time to be on the call. I think we should actually start with the name, because you sometimes hear ISIS, sometimes you hear ISIL, and sometimes you hear the Islamic State. The president last night referred to them as ISIL. That acronym stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. ISIS just stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The reason the administration prefers the term ISIL is that in Arabic, the group's the organization's name translates to the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, which itself loosely translates into the Levant. So that's why they prefer ISIL, but ISIS, ISIL, they're all the same thing. The organization has rebranded itself just the Islamic State in recent weeks, but the U.S. government basically refuses to call them that. Who are they? ISIL is basically a hybrid irregular army and terrorist organization based in a huge swath of territory that straddles the Iraq and Syria borders between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The organization started as a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was an affiliate of Al-Qaeda that was established under the leadership of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi during the American occupation of Iraq following the 2003 invasion. Zarqawi himself led the group until the summer of 2006 when he was killed in a U.S. airstrike. In late 2006, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI, formed an umbrella organization with a number of other kind of extremist jihadist insurgents, and they called themselves the Islamic State in Iraq, so ISI. At its height, during the American phase of the Iraq War, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or ISI, operated in Al-Anbar province in western Iraq, Nineveh and Kirkuk in northwestern and northern Iraq, most of Saladin province, and parts of Babel, Diyala, and even and Baghdad. Much of this territory was known during the war as the so-called Sunni Triangle, and if you look at a map, that makes sense kind of spatially. The group was significantly degraded by the U.S. military during the so-called surge, as well as by the Sunni awakening that started in Anbar province in late 2006 and spread into Baghdad and surrounding areas in 2007 and 2008 during the surge. A large number of Sunni tribes rebelled against Al-Qaeda in Iraq because of their brutality. And through kind of an enemy of my enemy logic. That is, they weren't huge fans of the Americans, but they feared Al-Qaeda in Iraq more, and they also feared Shia militia groups and, frankly, elements within the Iraqi government. And so they effectively aligned with American forces against what they perceived to be the greater evils. So through the course of U.S. military operations, especially extraordinarily effective special operations forces raids against al-Qaeda, as a consequence of the Sunni awakening, al-Qaeda in Iraq basically was beaten back to a very kind of marginal force by the time the U.S. withdrew from Iraq at the end of 2011. But since that time, the group has gradually rebuilt itself, not only in Iraq, but also in next door in Syria. What became ISIL eventually grew significantly under the leadership of a guy named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was an insurgent who had actually once been in U.S. custody in Iraq, and he was released in 2010. He wasn't released in 2010. He became the leader of the organization in 2010 after the U.S. military had killed the top two leaders in al-Qaeda in Iraq. In late 2011, members of al-Qaeda in Iraq started to travel to Syria, and they actually helped start an organization called the Al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda's local affiliate in Syria. And that organization kind of announced itself in early 2012. And then in 2013, al-Qaeda in Iraq itself moved into Syria and rebranded itself as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. So what's important to keep in mind is that for a while there were basically two affiliates of al-Qaeda in Syria, al-Nusra and ISIL. Both of them originated from members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. But they soon basically had a falling out. They became, even though they originated from the same organization and they both were affiliates of al-Qaeda, they started competing with one another violently. And the ISIL branch was so brutal that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan, the guy who replaced Osama bin Laden, basically kicked ISIL out of the club. They said, go home, stay out of Syria, go back to Iraq, let al-Nusra take the fight to the Assad regime and others in Syria. You go back to Iraq. And ISIL said no. And basically what that led to was Zarqawi disowning ISIL in February of 2014. Despite this kind of separation, ISIL remained active. They remained active in Syria, making significant military gains and seizing territory all up and down the Euphrates River, most notably in a place called Raqqa, Raqqa province and the city itself of Raqqa, which now basically serves as ISIL's capital in Syria. And simultaneously, the group started to make inroads in western and northern Iraq, intimidating rivals, assassinating members of the Iraqi security forces, etc. And in early 2014, the group effectively took control of the two most important cities in Anbar province, Fallujah and Ramadi. Anbar province has basically been the heart of the Sunni insurgency during the American phase of the war, and Fallujah and Ramadi were the scene of significant efforts by the Americans to root out AQI and other insurgents during the war. Then, most spectacularly, in June of this year, ISIL captured Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, which is in northwestern Iraq near the Tigris River, followed by a string of kind of stunning military gains all up and down the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. This was facilitated by basically the collapse of about four Iraqi army divisions who kind of basically fled the battlefield, losing most of their equipment. I mean, what's interesting is if you actually see images of ISIL on television or some of the videos that they've posted, a lot of times they're driving around in American-made Humvees, and those are basically things they liberated from the Iraqi security forces. ISIL is no longer part of al-Qaeda, but it basically shares al-Qaeda's extreme Salafi jihadist ideology and the dreams of establishing a pan-Islamic empire known as the Caliphate. So ISIL's original aim was to establish a pan-Islamic state known as the Caliphate in the Sunni-majority regions of Iraq. But following its involvement in the Syrian civil war, this expanded to include controlling an Islamic state in Sunni-majority areas straddling Iraq and Syria. At the end of June of this year, June 29th, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIL, rebranded his organization the Islamic State, described it as a caliphate, and named himself caliph. Ostensibly as the caliphate and as the caliph, he's the most important, supposed to be the most important Muslim world leader in the world, and everybody else should be flocking to basically serve him. It hasn't quite worked out that way yet. Although ISIL is basically focused on what terrorist experts would call the near enemy, that is, focused on enemies inside Iraq and Syria, it has said that it views a confrontation with the United States, the so-called far enemy, as inevitable. And while counterterrorism officials in the United States have repeatedly said that the group, they don't have any evidence that the group is actively plotting against the U.S. homeland, obviously ISIL has recently beheaded two American journalists, releasing videos of those gruesome deeds. And there is a concern that if ISIL is allowed to have a safe haven in Iraq and Syria, that it could launch attacks not only in the region or against Europe, but potentially against the United States, especially because there are hundreds, perhaps more, Western foreign fighters that take part in ISIL, and many of them therefore have passports that would allow them to be get more easily into the West. There's also a concern among counterterrorism officials that the very competition between ISIL and al-Qaeda could drive ISIL to eventually attack the United States in order to kind of establish its bona fides with the global jihadi movement. So that's why I think why the Obama administration and so many others are so worried about the ISIL threat. It raises the question, why has this group been so successful? It's unclear how many fighters are actually part of ISIL. Estimates suggest there may be as many as 10,000 ISIL fighters in Iraq and several thousand more in Syria. As I mentioned a moment ago, there are thousands of foreign fighters, hundreds of which, at the very least, are from Western countries. They are arguably the richest, or at least among the richest, kind of insurgent terrorist organizations in the world, and they're largely self-financing. And the reason for that is that they control some oil resources around Raqqa and around Mosul. They also engage in a whole bunch of criminal activities like extortion, kidnapping for ransom, and other things to raise money. And the estimates that I've seen suggest they may be making about $1 million a day in revenue. They also looted hundreds of millions of dollars from Mosul's central bank. So they're pretty flush with cash at the moment. But a lot of ISIL strength don't just come from, how many troops they have and how much money they have, but really say more about how weak their opponents have been. Let's just put it this way. 10,000 guys, I don't care how capable they are, could not control all of Western and Northwestern Iraq. It's simply impossible. I mean, the United States couldn't control that territory during the American phase of the war with 50,000 of the best armed, soldiers and Marines in the world. So 10,000 guys cannot control that amount of territory unless they're getting a lot of help and acquiescence from the local population, from local tribes, and from other opportunistic insurgent groups. And that's basically what has happened in Iraq, where, ISIL, the former AQI, is still basically hated and despised by a lot of people in Western and Northern Iraq. They're also feared. The populace in general, the Sunni populace, doesn't share their ideology. There's no evidence that they want to live under an Islamic State caliphate. However, the same enemy of my enemy logic that led the Sunnis to rebel against al-Qaeda in Iraq during the American surge has led them to basically turn against the Iraqi government and ally with ISIL in order to counter what they perceive to be an illegitimate, dangerous, and exclusionary government in Baghdad, principally under now former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The Sunnis were, largely excluded from the security services, discriminated against. There were purges and witch hunts against Sunni politicians. There were raids against Sunni towns that landed a lot of Sunni men in jail, killed some innocent folks. Maliki was perceived as basically ruling as an autocrat, accruing a lot of extra constitutional executive power. And in general, Baghdad was seen as in the clutches of a Shia Islamist majoritarian government closely aligned with Iran. And so this deeply alienated a huge chunk of the Sunni population, which I think opened up the space for ISIL to kind of push against an open door in Western and Northern Iraq. Also helping ISIL was the fact that the Iraqi security forces were not as well trained or as capable of fighting as many believed. Part of that was a degradation caused by the fact that the United States withdrew its forces at the end of 2011 under an agreement with the Iraqi government. But part of it was also that Maliki had replaced a lot of the best commanders in the Iraqi army with kind of sycophants and kiss-ups, but folks who were not particularly capable as leaders. So all of those, I think, are the reasons why ISIL has been so successful, even though it's only about 10,000 guys. But I think it's important to recognize at the end of the day that they have a bunch of weaknesses, and it's important to tick these off because I think President Obama's strategy seeks to exploit these weaknesses. For one thing, they're not popular among the Sunni populace. I've already talked about that. Many of its allies are just basically opportunistic collaborators or are intimidated, and under the right circumstances, I think it is the judgment of most analysts, they could flip back against ISIL and isolate them kind of politically, socially. ISIL has also generated enormous geopolitical antibodies. Not only the United States and our allies in Europe and elsewhere, but in the region. You know, it's like in a region where nobody agrees on anything, the fact that ISIL is a danger that has to be wiped out is something that all the parties agree on. It's something the Iranians agree on, the Saudis agree on, the Qataris, the Turks, the Israelis, the Egyptians. Everybody agrees that ISIL is a threat that needs to be pushed back, which provides an opportunity, I think, for an international coalition. Operationally, ISIL simply lacks the manpower to hold enormous amounts of territory once they come under pressure. And if it masses on the roads or otherwise out in the open in order to reinforce or to move, it will become increasingly vulnerable to U.S. Air power. So a lot of these kind of stunning successes were before the United States started engaging in airstrikes. Now that the United States is actively policing Iraqi skies, it's going to be a lot harder for ISIL to move around in mass like they have been doing. It's also possible that a confluence, I think it's possible that a confluence of political, geopolitical, and military steps could substantially reverse the group's momentum, although it's not going to happen overnight. It will likely take some time. So let me just say a few things about what I think the Obama administration strategy has been, and then we can open it up for questions. So the initial reaction to ISIL after they captured Mosul was to send a few hundred U.S. military advisors to Iraq. A couple of hundred other folks were sent there to reinforce the security of our embassy, but a few hundred advisors were sent to Iraq to basically assess the Iraqi security forces and figure out if there was anybody we could work with. At the same time, the administration basically sent a signal to Baghdad that they were going to condition any military assistance in the current fight to Baghdad forming a more inclusive government. Fortuitously, there were elections in Iraq a few months ago, and Iraq was in the middle of their government formation process. So they had an opportunity constitutionally and democratically to basically get rid of Nouri al-Maliki and replace him with somebody else. And through pressure by the United States, through pressure by Iran, and through pressure by the clerical establishment in Najaf, they basically pushed Maliki aside and replaced him with a guy named Haider al-Abadi, who is also a Shia Islamist, but appears committed to forming a much more inclusive government. So Maliki was removed more than a month ago, and Haider al-Abadi, just in the past week or so, formed a new government. As that was culminating, as the new government was coming together, there was a humanitarian crisis facing the Yazidis, a small minority population in northern Iraq, in a place called Mount Sinjar, which basically triggered the first in what became a string of U.S. airstrikes against ISIL targets that were meant to halt their momentum. As the president said last night, U.S. Central Command has launched about 150 airstrikes against ISIL targets, and the goals have thus far been to protect vulnerable minority populations like the Yazidis, to protect U.S. personnel because advances by ISIL were threatening U.S. personnel in Erbil up in Kurdish areas, and to protect critical infrastructure like the Mosul Dam and the Haditha Dam. But before last night, the U.S. strategy has been, I think, kind of deliberate, careful, cautious, incremental, and relatively small. I think the president signaled last night a shift towards a more ambitious objective of degrading but eventually then destroying ISIL. So what does that strategy entail? I think first, it's clear the president's willing to have a much more expansive air campaign against ISIL, not only in Iraq but potentially in Syria, which crosses quite a Rubicon for him since the administration has been reluctant to get directly militarily involved in Syria. There's also a component of the strategy that will focus on basically standing up capable partners on the ground because the president's ruled out, you know, large numbers of Americans on the ground as combat troops. So who's going to be on the ground fighting ISIL? The answer is different in different places. In Iraq, it means sending more trainers to Iraq to get the Iraqi security forces in better shape, to pass them intelligence, help enable their operations, and also provide equipment to them and to the Kurdish Peshmerga in the north. And part of the plan is also to try to stand up kind of National Guard units in local areas in Sunni communities. So kind of tribal militia, but that are directly integrated into the Iraqi security forces as kind of a way to reawaken the Sunni awakening and arm them to fight back against ISIL. On the Syria side of the border, the president has a proposal in front of Congress for $500 million in training and equipment and a train and equip program. There have already been reports that the United States has a smaller scale program led by the CIA in places like Jordan and Turkey, but this would be an overt program led by the Pentagon. It's unclear to me where exactly it would be based. You may have part of it in Jordan, but there are also reports in the last couple of days that that Saudi Arabia has agreed to host at least some training. Then there's a political component. The administration is going to continue to push Baghdad on political reforms to make sure the new government is more inclusive, but also to devolve more authority to localities through something the administration sometimes calls functioning federalism, that is, devolving a lot of money, political autonomy, and security responsibility to local communities as a political incentive to kind of flip against ISIL. And then on the Syria side of the equation, things are a little less clear, but it appears the administration is trying to build leverage through arming, doing more to help the moderate opposition, and through perhaps airstrikes in order to kind of push the regime towards an eventual political transition. Diplomatically, they're kind of taking advantage of the fact that everybody in the world hates ISIL to construct a coalition to support all of these actions. So the coalition will involve NATO countries, Australia, Arab partners as well. Some will engage in direct military action, like the Brits or the Australians. Others will help provide training or provide arms. Others will be asked to crack down on the flow of foreign fighters across their borders or private financing from their citizens to ISIL and to support efforts to counter ISIL's ideology. And then there will be an extensive effort to share intelligence. And then last but not least, the administration has signaled that they will continue to provide humanitarian assistance to afflicted populations in Iraq, Syria, and surrounding states. So it's a pretty ambitious strategy. It doesn't pretend that you can reverse this challenge overnight. Reports suggest that they see this as a multi-year effort. But with that, why don't we open it up, Arena, for conversation.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Colin. Let's open it up to the students on the call.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our first question will come from the University of Puget Sound.
If the U.S. journalists had not been beheaded by ISIS, do you believe that President Obama would have pushed for a more aggressive airstrike campaign against ISIS?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it would also be helpful to me if the folks asking the question could say their name so I could talk a little bit more directly to you.
Chloe Simon.
Oh, thanks, Chloe. Thank you. It's all on the record, after all, so we have to have your name for the record. It's a counterfactual. It's difficult to know what would have happened otherwise. I do think that the beheadings of the two journalists, obviously were hugely symbolically important, and it was an example of ISIL kind of sticking a thumb in the eye of the president, right? I mean, it wasn't just that they engaged in these gruesome, horrific acts, killing Americans, which is bad enough, but they basically did so in a way that was taunting the president of the United States and threatening to do more unless he dialed back the airstrikes that were going on in Iraq. So I don't think any president could look at that threat and not be motivated to take more action. That said, even in the absence of these kind of gruesome beheadings, I think there was already a lot of kind of momentum within the U.S. government system to do more about ISIL. And the reason for that is that, the group is seen as hugely threatening. In the immediate sense, it's seen as, threatening to establish a kind of Taliban-like state in the heart of the Middle East, threatening a lot of our allies and a lot of our interests. That's not something that's we want to see happen no matter what. And then there was also a concern that over the long term, it could kind of metastasize into an organization that would strike against Western targets and potentially the United States. So actually, you know, you saw the United States doing things, the early parts of this strategy in terms of pushing the Iraqis to be have a more inclusive government, early airstrikes in places like Sinjar and Amerli, you know, a more aggressive and expeditious, you know, provision of security assistance to the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga forces in the north. You saw all of that happen before the journalists were killed. So I think the train was leaving the station already. The death of the journalist may have affected the timing somewhat, but I don't know that it affected the overall trajectory of or how seriously we took the threat.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Pitzer College.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaur. I have two questions and just need your insights. One is, what is the nature of the cooperation that has been talked about between the U.S. and Iran? What are some of the complicating factors in that? And my second question is with regard to Syria. If U.S. is going to bomb ISIL in Syria, is that not helping the Syrian government to consolidate its power?
Yeah, those are both great questions, and they're actually interrelated, obviously, because the government in Syria is a close ally of Iran. So let me take them in order, but you know, the answers will kind of interrelate. You know, U.S. officials have been clear that there is no direct coordination between the United States and Iran as it relates to battlefield coordination. It is true that there have been reports that, you know, Shia militia that are trained and armed by the Iranians have been active in areas where the United States has engaged in airstrikes, most recently in a place called Amerli. But there's no evidence, nor is there reason to believe that there's direct coordination between U.S. military and Iranian-backed Shia militia groups. And it's also very tricky for some of the reasons you mentioned. On the one hand, the United States and Iran, in a sense, share some common interests in Iraq. They don't want to see ISIL establish a safe haven there. They don't want to see the collapse of the Baghdad government. They don't want to see Iraq descend back into civil war and become a failed state. We have an acute interest in that, so do the Iranians, and we've been talking to the Iranians about that. And so we did. There was some level, I think, not necessarily coordination, but at least a conversation between the United States and Iran during the early political phase of this strategy, which was to try to push Prime Minister Maliki aside and get a new government in place that was more responsive to the legitimate grievances of Iraq's population. So I do think that there has been some, you know, political cooperation, but I think the United States has been really wary about military coordination. So, but they share basic common interests in many respects in Iraq at the moment. Obviously, they diverge; they're on opposite sides of with one another in Syria. You know, the president has said that Assad should go. We have been pushing for a political transition that would eventually move Assad out. The United States and our closest allies in the region, countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey and others, have been providing both lethal and non-lethal support to the opposition fighting Assad. And Iran is on the other side of the equation. Not only do they back Assad directly, but they have advisors on the ground from the Revolutionary Guard, and they also have fighters from Lebanese Hezbollah, which is, you know, Iran's principal proxy in the region fighting in Syria. So it's complicated. You know, there's that saying I used in my remarks, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that's sometimes true. But in today's Middle East, sometimes it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend and my enemy and neither and both. So it's a pretty complex situation. And one of the complexities operationally is what your second question was about, which is how can we go after ISIL in Syria and not basically help Assad? At one level, you can't. I mean, if you're going to go after ISIL that is also at war with Assad, if you degrade ISIL, you may, in some sense, help Assad. But that's a little too simplistic. A lot of it depends on the nature of the targets. There are a lot of areas of Syria that if you removed ISIL from the battlefield, it's not clear that your regime would immediately backfill those positions. It's also the case that a lot of what ISIL is doing is actually going to war against the moderate opposition. That is, they're not just fighting Assad, they're fighting other opposition groups. And so degrading ISIL is also a mechanism to strengthen opposition groups. So the Obama administration has no incentive to work directly with Assad or to see their actions strengthen Assad, and I think they'll be pretty cautious about their military actions on the ground in Syria to, you know, do their best to make sure that they don't inadvertently help Assad out.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from St. Edward's University.
My question comes from, it's mostly because I heard yesterday on NPR, foreign experts say that there's no way to keep the Kurds after helping them and supplying them with arms to fight ISIL. I just want to know what's your understanding on, like, what would happen after with the Kurds. Would they become independent? Would they become part of the Iraqi government?
Yeah. So for those of you who aren't following this minutely, you know, there is a region in Iraq called the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government. So the Kurds in northern Iraq are part of Iraq. But there are also Kurds throughout the region. There are Kurds in Turkey, there are Kurds in Iran, there are Kurds in Syria. And to some degree, they're all kind of in rebellion or in opposition to their own governments. And so there's been a question for a long time about whether a Kurdish state would basically materialize in the Middle East somewhere. And Iraq seemed the most obvious place because the KRG has a fair amount of oil wealth. They're a well-governed and stable place, certainly compared to anywhere else in Iraq. And the politicians there have significant nationalist ambitions. And so for a long time, there's been talk about, you know, when is the KRG going to basically break away and form their own state? For years, the problem has not been whether they have the military capability to do so. The Peshmerga is a reasonably capable force. I think we may have overestimated them a bit, as some of the initial success by ISIL in the north against Kurdish forces demonstrated. But once the United States started engaging in some airstrikes, the Peshmerga, it kind of stiffened the backbone of the Peshmerga, and they have been fighting back pretty well. I don't really think the key part of this equation is military. That is, that the Kurds are thinking, okay, well, does the military balance of power allow us to leave Iraq and form our own state? I think it's more geopolitical and economic. That is, an independent Kurdistan is simply not viable unless they have the diplomatic support of the United States and the diplomatic and economic support of Turkey. Diplomatic support for the United States because it's essential to recognize an independent Kurdistan and facilitate their integration into the international community, and also, frankly, to provide a security umbrella against a lot of threats in the region. Turkey is important because Turkey has its own Kurdish minority problem, and so they've been reluctant to see the KRG break away and form its own state. On the other hand, they've forged very close economic trade and energy relationships with northern Iraq. And the Turks basically for now have signaled that they would prefer, all else being equal, the Kurds to stay in Iraq. But they appear to be more open to an independent Kurdistan than before. So I think for the moment, both the Americans and the Turks are telling the KRG to stay in Iraq and push for a more inclusive government in Iraq that basically will compromise on issues you care about, like oil revenue and territorial disputes, but don't break away and form your own state that would be poorer and less secure. For the moment, that's the talking point, and I think both the Americans and the Turks, you know, believe that that's the right approach. Over time, it's difficult to say how these things are going to evolve, and the worse the situation is in Iraq, the more inclined the Kurds might be to break away. So I think the American perspective is that they would prefer an Iraq that was kind of a very loose, has a very loose federal or even confederal structure such that the Kurds have sufficient autonomy inside Iraq that they don't feel like they have to leave. So that's what we're pushing for, but we'll have to stay tuned.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Suwannee University of the South.
What's been the day-to-day effect of ISIS on individual localities that they control? Is part of developing the caliphate a disruption of existing individual communities?
It's a great question, and frankly, the reporting is kind of all over the place. There's some reporting that suggests that ISIL has kind of learned from the excesses of al-Qaeda in Iraq. That is, you know, one of the things that turned the Sunni tribes against al-Qaeda in Iraq in the lead-up and then throughout the surge was just the sheer brutality of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so there's some indication that they've tried to do more to let locals kind of govern themselves, to provide services and then kind of put a kinder, gentler spin on ISIL. But there's a lot of other reporting that suggests that they haven't really changed their stripes very much. They've certainly been brutal to minority populations, threatening Yazidis and Christians with extinction, you know, mass executions of Shia Arabs, and, you know, certainly assassinations, intimidation, coercion against local elites to get people to play ball. So these are not nice guys. And ideologically, their entire vision just sits completely 180 out from where a lot of even, you know, very religious Sunnis want Iraq to be. So, you know, strict separation of the sexes in everything, requirements that women stay indoors. You know, cracking down on smoking, which if you've ever been in the Middle East, you know that's a big deal. Cracking down on alcohol consumption, which is kind of against Islamic law, but frankly is quite common in places like Western Iraq. And also cutting into economic activities, whether it be illegal economic trade or illicit smuggling. So I think that day to day, ISIL is a extraordinarily brutal organization with an ideology that is extremely unattractive to most of the folks in the places they're trying to govern. And so, even if they've learned some of the lessons from the last Sunni awakening and are trying to be a little bit better than they were before, there's still plenty bad, I think, to create motivations for local communities to rise up against them if those local communities believe that the alternative is better.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the Colin Powell School of Civic and Global Leadership.
Hi. My question is arming moderates in Syria really a good idea, especially considering that we've had this vicious cycle going on for a while now? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the administration has clearly been, nervous and cautious about providing too many weapons too fast to too many groups in Syria since the very beginning of the conflict. I think that, you know, the concerns were, do we know enough? We don't know enough about the opposition to know who the good guys and bad guys are. That if you provide a lot of sophisticated weaponry to some groups, those groups could end up being bad actors, or they could simply lose control of those weapons, and they could be, you know, as their positions are overrun, or if there are defections or whatever, a lot of those weapons could find their way into the hands of worse actors. You saw some of this in Iraq, right? I mean, we provided billions and billions and billions of dollars of sophisticated weaponry to the Iraqis, and then four divisions of the Iraqi army collapse, and a lot of their equipment falls into the hands of ISIL. In fact, a lot of the targets that the United States has hit in Iraq, if you look at the actual list that the Pentagon has provided of what types of weapon systems have been targeted by the United States, it's like we've blown up 37 Humvees, and we've blown up an MRAP, and we've blown up some tanks, and some of those were ours. All the Humvees were ours. The MRAP was ours. That is, we gave them to the Iraqi army, and ISIL captured them. So there's always a concern that it's hard to identify separate the good guys from the bad guys, and it's hard to control what you give. That said, I think we've come to the point where the threat from ISIL is so acute to American interests in the region and over the medium term or long term, potentially to the United States homeland, that I think that the administration is in a place where they're more comfortable doing more to help kind of the nationalist opposition or the so-called moderate opposition. I still think we're going to be, you know, very careful about vetting these guys trying to make sure that this stuff doesn't fall into the wrong hands. But it's really, really tricky.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from American University.
Dr. Kyle, hi. This is Marwa Al Sayed. I am an MIS student at American University. I have 2 points, actually. Number one, I quote you. You said that on the Syrian part of the equation, things aren't clear. What's the percentage of the U.S. Succeeding in defeating ISIL in Syria without what I call the help and existence of Syrian Peshmergas? My second point is that I argue that Obama's strategy is incomplete and defective for two points. Number one, the U.S. had already armed and trained the U.S. the Iraqi troops before, and the Iraqi troops backed down and retreated when they faced ISIL at El Musul. The second point is the issue of succeeding depends on military action, just military action, or defeating ISIL ideology-wise? Thank you.
So those are great questions. I guess that my point about the Syria strategy being less clear is simply that I think there are certain variables that remain uncertain. It's not clear whether Congress, for example, is going to approve the $500 million in training and equipment assistance to the Syrian opposition. We're starting to hear signs that countries like Saudi Arabia are going to step up and do things, but we still, I think, you know, Secretary Kerry is meeting with Saudi and Jordanian and Turkish and other leaders this week to try to sort out the details. So I would encourage folks to stay tuned. You know, the role of the Kurdish of the so-called Syrian Peshmerga. I don't know if you're talking about the Kurds themselves in Syria, which have basically carved out their own local space and are providing some security. It's not clear to me what interactions we're likely to have with them, although as part of this strategy, although clearly the Kurds in Iraq are cooperating with the Kurds in Syria. But if you're talking about, you know, more broadly, how committed are we to kind of bolstering the Syrian moderate opposition, I think the administration is actually fairly committed. You know, it raises the second question, though, of like, hey, we spent, you know, almost a decade building up the Iraqi security forces, and they weren't up to the fight. So what leads us to believe that any of this is going to work? It's a good question. The reality is that, you know, none of these forces are perfect. That's true throughout the Arab world. It's true throughout the world. But even in Iraq, where, you know, about a quarter of the Iraqi army disappeared, there are still very capable units. I mean, I think you saw some of the counterterrorism units and some of the Peshmerga units who retook the Mosul Dam, for example. ISIL is not 500 feet tall, okay? They're 10,000 guys. Many of them are fairly experienced and well-trained, but there are hundreds of thousands of troops on the other side of this equation. So even if only, you know, a relatively small percentage of those troops are sufficiently competent and capable, et cetera, you can still do considerable damage to ISIL, especially if you're doing more to train and advise them, which I think is what the Obama strategy envisions. In terms of your point about, you know, the military not being enough, there has to be an ideological component. I think my sense is the president couldn't agree with you more. That things like airstrikes and providing armaments and training and advice and intelligence are necessary but not sufficient to roll back ISIL. He said as much last night. It's been a constant theme in the administration's approach, not only to Iraq and Syria, but to the region as a whole, that there's no purely military solution to these problems. But there has to be a military component. The question is, what are the other components? And I think, you know, as I mentioned in my remarks, in Iraq, there's a political component focusing on inclusion and devolution, decentralization. And that's already underway and showing some early signs of success. In Syria, I think it still isn't completely clear, but it seemed from the president's remarks last night that the general strategy is to use what we're doing in arming the moderate opposition and perhaps doing some airstrikes in Syria to generate leverage with all parties to move towards some political transition and de-escalation in Syria. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And then I think one of the reasons why we're trying to craft as large a Sunni Arab coalition in the region as possible is to not only increase the legitimacy of our actions, make it clear that we're not, you know, Iran's Air Force or the Shia Air Force or Assad's Air Force or anybody else, that this is an anti-ISIL campaign, to basically counter some of the ideological arguments that ISIL somehow represents the mainstream of Sunni Islamist thought, which it doesn't. It's unclear what exactly, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Turkey and others will commit to do. I think we'll find that out in the coming days, but I think the administration's acutely aware of the need to have an ideological and political component of this.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the New College of Florida.
Hello. I had read somewhere that there was a possible post-conflict solution to the to some of the issues in Iraq, and it would be separating Iraq into three states, a Sunni state, a Shia state, and a Kurdish state. So I want to know what the pros and cons of that would be, and what if that would ever possibly even come up in a conversation in reality.
Sure. So this is something that's been talked about for years. When Iraq descended into sectarian civil war in 2006, so you know you get the U.S. invasion in 2003. Almost immediately after the invasion, you get the beginning of a Sunni insurgency. That escalates in 2003, 2004, 2005, and then it tips into an all-out kind of communal sectarian civil war in 2006. When it looked like Iraq was becoming a failed state and was basically unsalvageable, a number of analysts, started to ask this question, well, maybe Iraq as a whole is unsalvageable and you need to split it into three entities, kind of a Shiistan in the center and south, a Sunnistan in the west and northwest, and a Kurdish, autonomous Kurdish area in the rest, up north. This is sometimes confused with a different argument, which is that you keep a unified Iraq, but you have a very loose federal or confederal system where local communities have enormous autonomy over education and services and health and infrastructure and security and political affairs. And basically, all the central government in Baghdad does is write the checks and provide external security, and then almost everything else gets done by the regions, provinces, districts, et cetera. Which would not partition Iraq in the sense of creating three little states, but it would loosen the control of the central government in ways that are supposed to achieve the same objective. My view is that second idea is a good idea potentially, and I think it's something the Obama administration is thinking about a lot. Vice President Biden had an op-ed a couple of weeks ago where he referred to a concept called functioning federalism, which seemed to hint at some of this. So do some of the things the president said last night about standing up National Guard units, basically, in Sunni areas in Iraq. But a straightforward, hard partition of breaking Iraq into three states is a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea because it's bad in general to set the precedent that every time there's a conflict, we're going to split states up. That's a recipe for generating a lot more conflicts in a lot more states. In this particular case, at least one of the three states would not be economically viable, Sunnistan. All of the oil revenue is either in the deep south of the country or in the north, where the Shia are the majority, or in the north, where the Kurds are. Sunnistan would have almost no economic viability. So you'd end up having, three states, all of which are weaker than one state, and all of which are surrounded by enemies. And then you also have the problem that, you ostensibly are going to break up this country because of their domestic civil strife. But if you break them into three countries, those intra-state problems will become inter-state problems. That is, there will still be mixed populations. Shiistan will still have Sunnis in it. Sunnistan will still have Shia and Kurds in it. And so it just translates kind of a domestic problem into an international problem between the new states. And frankly, there's likely to be insurgencies by minority populations within those new states. So I think in general, a hard partition is a bad idea, and I don't really see a lot of serious advocates for that. But that thinking hard about forms of federalism and confederation is probably a good idea.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the University of Connecticut.
Hi, my name is Natalie from University of Connecticut. One of the arguments that I've heard in support of President Obama's strategy, and it's an argument that you reiterated earlier, is that if the U.S. does not increase its involvement and weaken ISIS now, then ISIS may, in fact, directly attack the United States. But what I'm wondering is, do you think that this new military strategy may, in fact, have the adverse effect of provoking such an attack?
Yeah. I mean, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I'm not privy to the types of intelligence that the president is, but there's been a general sense that a lot of the groups that either share Al Qaeda's ideology or are affiliated with them that have been operating in Syria and Iraq have the ultimate intention to strike the United States, and that was before we started dropping bombs in near Mount Sinjar or anywhere else. It's a central part of their ideology, frankly. I mean, one of the revolutionary components of al-Qaeda, the original al-Qaeda, was to transition away from just focusing on the so-called near enemies, the local enemies, the local regimes, and to shift the gaze towards the far enemy, which is really what led to the strikes in Africa in the late 1990s and the strike in Yemen by al-Qaeda, and then finally the 9/11 attacks. And since then, you see al-Qaeda affiliates in places like Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, plotting attacks against the U.S. homeland. So while a lot of the affiliates folks who either share al-Qaeda's ideology or are somehow loosely affiliated with them are focused for the moment on the near enemy, there's always the concern that they'll shift their focus towards the United States. And ISIL has signaled that they saw a confrontation with the United States as inevitable. Now, U.S. counterterrorism officials have said, and the U.S. administration officials have not, countered this, that there is no, immediate direct evidence that ISIL intends to, in the near term, attack the U.S. homeland. So I think the major driver of this is that there might be a medium or long-term threat to the homeland, but in the immediate term, ISIL is a threat to Iraq, it's a threat to the stability of Syria, it's a threat to the to all of our allies in the region. And because there are these hundreds and hundreds of individuals in ISIL and other similar groups with Western passports, it could be a threat to the West. And all of that would be true if we didn't lift a finger militarily. Moreover, now that they're killing Americans on TV, think of the precedent of being set that basically all you have to do is kill an American on and put the video on YouTube and you can intimidate the United States and back the president of the United States down. That sounds like a terrible precedent to set. So I don't rule out the fact that the more we hit them, the more they may be motivated to hit us. But I do rule out the argument that if we didn't hit them at all, they wouldn't be motivated to hit us. They are motivated to hit us. So that's an argument for going, if you're going to go after the group, go after them hard and make sure that you finish the job.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the University of Richmond.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this call. This is Stephen Long from the University of Richmond with my class of undergraduates here. And I was just wondering about this strategy. It strikes me that it seems to be driven by political considerations as much as it is by strategic considerations. If you think about what we're actually expecting to happen here, it seems like a combination of wishful thinking and maybe some kind of magic is going to make these airstrikes do things that previous airstrikes have not been able to do. We're going to train up the Iraqi army in a way that has not worked for several years. We're going to give them more money and equipment. We're going to work with the Kurds. We're going to work with moderate Shiites and Sunnis. And yet we've been trying a lot of those things, and they haven't really succeeded. And yet the one thing we haven't talked about in this whole call is the use of American ground troops. You just said if we're going to hit them, we have to hit them hard. But ground troops seem to be ruled out as a political consideration. So do you think the strategic goals can be fulfilled without some kind of direct ground intervention, at least special operations forces?
Yeah. So, the politics of this are dicey. I mean, the American public has been reluctant in general to come anywhere near the Syrian conflict for, just in general. You saw about, just a year ago, when President Obama was considering possible strikes against Syrian targets in the context of their use of chemical weapons, there was widespread opposition to that among the American public. The polls were overwhelmingly against it. Interestingly, the polls at the moment, seem to suggest that a significant majority of the American public sees ISIL as a threat, something that should be dealt with, and something that should be dealt with militarily, at least as part of it, as a component, as long as there aren't significant boots on the ground, which raises your question of, are we ruling out ground troops largely for political reasons? Look, I think that there's no doubt that there's no appetite in the American political system for reintroducing large numbers of ground troops in Iraq, let alone Syria. But that's not a purely political equation. After all, President Obama doesn't have to run for re-election again. If this is a multi-year effort, and the American public is dead set against, sending ground troops, it's politically unsustainable. That is, you just won't be able to do it. So the worst thing to do would be to send tens of thousands of soldiers, Marines, and others in, you know, back into Iraq and or into Syria in a climate where the American public would pull the plug or put a lot of pressure on other folks to pull the plug. As it relates to your specific question about do you need special operations forces on the ground, there are special operations forces on the ground. Many of the advisors, most of the advisors that have been sent to Iraq were sent there to establish joint operations centers in places like Baghdad and Erbil. And the goal of it is to basically help the Iraqis identify targets and go after those targets. And this is actually where air cover, air support is actually critical. You're totally right that there's no evidence in kind of the history of warfare that airstrikes alone can roll back groups like this. You need forces on the ground that are competent and capable. But what air support can do is provide really good real-time intelligence, both through manned and unmanned aircraft, what the military calls ISR, or intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, that can help ground forces target the enemy in real time, and small numbers of special operations forces working with those local forces can also you know, stiffen their backbone and provide them with critical pieces of intelligence and operational assistance. So I think you are going to see small numbers of special operations forces involved. They're just not going to, you know, be kicking down doors themselves and involved in a direct combat role. And that strikes me as sensible. And I will just say this. We saw that even limited airstrikes around Mount Sinjar and Emerli, when backed with ground troops, actually did push ISIL out of those areas. So I'm relatively, you know, confident that ISIL can be, that their momentum can at least be halted in Iraq. Rolling it back is going to require a political solution. And frankly, putting tens of thousands of American troops back into Iraq isn't going to help you get a political solution. It's going to create its own antibodies about a reoccupation and the war starting all over again and all of that. And I'm talking about political antibodies in Iraq. So I think the president's right to be wary of boots on the ground, both substantively and because it would be unsustainable politically.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the Howard University School of Law.
Hello, my name is Jimmy Covington from the Howard University School of Law. What are some steps you believe the administration could take to counter ISIL's propaganda and change the narrative that they're using to recruit Westerners and those de facto from the Middle East?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, part of it is it's always a challenge for us to counter the narrative coming out of any Islamist movement, because of course we don't have a lot of credibility in the, and you know, we may not be a credible voice in that conversation. So I think part of this is recruiting as many allies from the Muslim world and the Arab world to make these arguments as possible. You did hear the president last night basically make the argument that ISIL is neither Islamic nor a state. It's not Islamic because the vast majority of Muslims around the world find their worldview, you know, heretical and abhorrent. And it's not a state because it's not recognized as such, and nobody wants to live in it as a state. So I think that is an effort, actually, to push back against ISIL's kind of narrative that they are the Islamic State and that everybody should bow down to them throughout the Muslim world, and that the West should cower from their threat. You know, a lot of what will counter ISIL's propaganda is if they start to lose. You know, a lot of times, you know, when groups look like they have a lot of momentum on the ground, there's kind of a bandwagoning phenomenon. And I think that if it looks like, you know, if you go off to Syria and Iraq, you're not coming back, then some foreign fighters will be discouraged from doing that. The other thing that will discourage foreign fighters from going in recruitment is for countries like Turkey and some of our Gulf allies to do more to control their borders, stop the flow of freedom of foreign fighters, and to crack down on private financing. They're already taking steps in that direction. They need to do a heck of a lot more. So unfortunately, there's no silver bullet, but you kind of have to try to reverse their momentum, generate as many allies in that part of the world as possible to challenge their narrative, and also crack down just on the logistical means by which ISIL and groups like al-Nusra get fighters and money into Syria and Iraq.
Colin, I think we are out of time. Or do you have any final words for us before we close?
No, other than I appreciate everybody, again, taking time on the call, and your questions were great. So I'm sure I left a lot of, you know, at least metaphorical hands up in the air, but I look forward to maybe having a conversation with some of you later down the road.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I apologize to all of those questions that we could not get to, but we have a policy of trying to end on time at the Council on Foreign Relations. So Colin Call, again, thank you for sharing your insights with us today. I encourage people to follow your Twitter handle. Really follow you on Twitter at Colin Call. And we will encourage you to view our recently released info guide on the Sunni-Shia divide on our website at CFR.org. It's interactive and such sheds additional light on these issues. Our next call will be on Wednesday, September 24th, with Jaron Cohen, who is adjunct senior fellow at CFR and director of Google Ideas on technology, the effect of technology on international security and geopolitics. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on upcoming events and new CFR resources. So thank you all for your participation, and we look forward to talking with you again on September 24th.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.